The real great adventures of me, Tom Terrific, with Mighty Manfred the Wonder Dog.
I'm Tom Terrific, greatest hero ever. Terrific is the name for me, 'cause I'm so clever. I can be what I wanna be, and if you'd like to see, follow, come follow me. If you see a plane on high, a diesel train go roaring by, a bumblebee or a tree, it's me. When there is trouble, I'm there on the double, from Atlantic to Pacific. They know I'm Terrific.
I'm Mighty Manfred, the Wonder Dog, and Tom's ever faithful companion.
Yeah, don't forget it. You got that right. Terrible Tommy, Tom Terrific, right here in the bunker. North Central Indiana on another overcast day. I don't think it's going to rain, but who knows? We get rain every other day now. This is going to be like Southern Louisiana one of these days if it keeps on. I hope not. I hate those Louisiana bugs. We're at P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana. That's WARSAW. Warsaw, Indiana, P.O. Box 401. And our website is resist.com. That's where you go to get your better than Harvard education. You're not going to get an education at Harvard. You're going to get indoctrinated into the ruling class, maybe, if you kill enough people and support enough wars, that is. Well, it's Thursday again here in the bunker. Yeah. You know, I finally fired up my dehumidifier down here in the dungeon. I'm telling you, it's a good thing I did. I didn't realize how much moisture was down here within these walls, man. It takes about a week, maybe less, and I take out about 2 or 3 gallons of water out of that thing just from the bunker, man. I'll tell you, it's a lot drier down here. Yeah, and Thor's Day. I love the sound of the word, Thor's Day. All these guys asking me whether I'm supporting Donald Trump. I don't support anybody because I don't believe in the presidency. I want to see the whole thing break up, go forward to the Articles of Confederation and have a consolidation maybe of states that have independence and who make their own rules and agree or disagree. None of them rich enough to build atomic bombs and things like that. And that's what I think. So I say, yeah, I like Donald Trump as an instigator and an agitator. But look, boys and girls, just like I said about some of the people in the past that ran for president, what was that little short guy's name way back in the 90s? Well, I ain't got time to rack my brain for it. But anyhow, I said back then, you can't ever trust a billionaire. If a white working man thinks he can trust a billionaire with the reins of power, forget it. Donald Trump is no exception. You can have fun with Donald Trump. You can say you support him. Oh, boy, 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 boy. He's not going to become president. Don't worry about it. In fact, I don't think he can, because I don't believe, when it comes down to the wire and the Federal Election Code Commission demands his financial information, there's no way in hell, I don't believe, that Trump would have the balls to or the desire to give the Federal Election Commission all that information. So anyhow, I think you're getting all shook up over not too much, but one thing for sure, he's got the progressives scratching where they don't itch. I like that. He didn't say that much about the Mexicans, other than the fact we're getting the wrong kind, and we have gotten millions of the wrong kind. Everything he said is true, but they're going absolutely apeshit over it. In Univision, I'd pull their plug in a heartbeat. Any of those Galavision, Univision, Spicovision, pull the plug on those bastards. Now, I got something. As you know, it took a long time and a great evolution, but I started turning against the war mongers way back in the Vietnam War, and I've told you about that. I refused to pay my income taxes to support the war, and I've been anti-war ever since, because I know the guys behind it and how rotten they are and how crooked they are and how warmongerish they are and how they don't give a shit about anybody getting their ass blown off, and they don't give a shit about the veterans coming back or anything else. They give all kinds of platitudes. Oh, it's terrible. We love our heroes. Send in 1995 for the wounded warrior. I gag when I see that stuff. You know, and even a lot of the veterans fall for that shit. That's what so drives you crazy. Well, anyhow, I've got something to share with you that I found last night wandering around on the web. And that's a series. It's called The Great War Diaries. The Great War Diaries. It's about the First World War. And you know, they sort of gloss over the First World War. In fact, they just were commemorating it a few months ago, but they didn't really get into the horrors of the First World War, which were actually appear almost to be worse, and probably were worse, than the Second World War. And they still didn't learn anything. This is a series made up of hours of real film, black and white film of the time and of the day and of the fight, and then also actors in between acting out roles as soldiers and so forth. This is the best anti-war series I think I've ever seen, and I think I've seen them all. So if you've got a young kid, male or female, that's talking about, I'm going to join up and go over there and save the United States from those ragheads, well, sit him down in front of a television and make him watch the whole series. And I'm pretty sure when he gets done watching the whole series of this, the Great War Diaries, he'll decide to take out his frustrations and testosterone in other areas. You know, boxing, street fighting, anything but going off to war, directed by these psychopaths that sit back in their ivory towers and most of the time escape any wounds or anything at all, prison or anything. And like that. So, you know, Kaiser Bill, he didn't go to jail or prison. He just fled the country. And that's the way it goes. Look at Bush. That son of a bitch, him and his sidekick. Damn, I hate him so bad I can't even think of his name. But anyhow, they're sitting in their big houses, drinking their mint juleps. All their sycophant, idiot, sheep worshippers coming around. Oh, you were a wonderful president. You were so wonderful. You saved us from what? Saved us from what? Well, to sort of get this off the ground here, I'm going to play you a little bit from Max Kaiser this morning, where he pretty well, Max, he's an American, you know, he's living in England, but he's pinned the tail on the donkey as far as the makeup of the American people and all their 300 million weapons, and only a fraction of them got the balls to raise those weapons against the government, which has screwed them, robbed them, raped them, and now turned all the huddled masses of the Negro world and everybody else on us. And yet, how many have picked up that gun and done anything about it? No, I think the only thing they have guns for is an investment so they can trade them back and forth. They're not going to use them. They keep talking. I remember, and I've told you before, about that bumper sticker that they used to have back in the 80s, I guess it was. They can have my gun when they pry it out of my cold, dead hands. And I used to say, yeah, they will. If they want your gun, they're going to take your gun. Are you kidding? if the National Guard or the Northern Command come around in their trucks, just started going down the street block by block with loudspeakers, they'd turn out your guns. We're picking up the guns. And a lot of them would come right on out the front door, throw them in the street and out the windows and like that. But some wouldn't. And then the loudspeaker would say, "Now I said all the guns into the street." And the guy would get out of the truck with his 9mm, walk up to the front door. Guy comes to the front door, a bullet in the head, throw him out in the street. "I said I want all the guns." And believe me, these lily-livered sons of bitches that are all around us, they throw those guns out there, they wouldn't fire a shot in defense. That's the state of the white race today.
Welcome to the Kaiser Report. I'm Max Kaiser. You know, Aristotle predicted this day. Republics decline into democracies, and democracies degenerate into despotisms. He was right. We long ago declined into a democracy, both in Europe and in America. We, in fact, have been invading nations around the world, not to bring them a republic, as Napoleon had in a previous generation, but to bring democracy. And now, indeed, we are on the verge of despotism. A, perhaps quiet one, but a despotism nevertheless. An absolute rule by bankers and debt, by secret trade deals, and a parallel justice system in which our rights are no longer inalienable, but one-sided financial contracts in which only the creditor has unalienable rights. Ha ha! Yes.
Max, well, we're looking at the continuing aftermath of Greece and also looking around the world at how other people have fought, or other nations and peoples are fighting back or not fighting back against this financial despotism. And first, I was thinking of, you know, Jean-Claude Juncker, the unelected head of the European Commission. He said to Greece that something along the lines that you shouldn't commit suicide because you're afraid of dying, which, of course, made me think of Patrick Henry saying, "Give me liberty or give me death." And Patrick Henry, along with Samuel Adams and Thomas Paine, introduced the notion of republicanism, where the primary focus is on liberty and unalienable rights, like the people of Greece have, that regardless of any contracts or regardless of any vote, you cannot deny the people their liberty.
Yeah, well, Juncker and the whole eurocratic, sclerotic, bureaucratic cadre of fat pigs that have been chowing down on the misery of the Greek people and others around the continent are waking up to this reality that maybe they have feet of clay. You know, maybe they're not godlike in those ways. And it'll be fun to watch them run out of town in one way or another.
You know, here again, we have the unalienable rights of the Greek people. And Stacey Herbert, that's me, I tweeted, you know, at the time that capital controls and bank holidays were introduced, I said, "My Greek friends look north. Our friends in Iceland endured capital controls whilst ridding themselves of banksters. You can do it too." So by ridding themselves of these despots that are the, you know, the bankers who say that their contracts are unalienable. Only their contracts are, these pieces of paper, not your rights as an individual human.
Yeah, well, this is the age of the one-way contract. This is the age where creditors have all the rights, debtors have no rights. Even when the debts being foisted onto the debtors are conceived illegitimately or have no basis in law, this is the very definition of colonialism and imperialism. So the Greece doesn't want to be a vassal state for a corrupt bureaucrat like Juncker, who said also famously that when the going gets tough, you have to lie. He said publicly that he lies to cover up his shameful disregard for not only human rights, civil rights, and the rule of law, but even good common sense. As I mean, despots in the past, I'm sorry, but occasionally they run into an unstoppable force, and they wish they hadn't opened that can of worms, so to speak.
Okay, so we went from republic to democracy to now a despotism, and this is one of the problems that we're seeing with Greece and the whole Eurozone area, is that there's too much democracy now. So what they want to bring in is this financial rule of law, this despotism, where they get the parallel trade deals, the TPP, the TTIP sort of deals, and a separate justice system. One of the things, for example, that they want to introduce is that fracking. So no corporation would be denied the right to frack unless the nation, the sovereign nation, the people, had to pay them compensation for the potential income they could have earned. And this weekend, the UK, Lancashire Council, they basically forbade fracking in their area. And it reminds me, of course, of Denton, Texas, where the people voted to ban fracking in Denton, Texas, where it all started, by the way. And the legislature then introduced the bill, a law, saying that they are not allowed to ban fracking.
Yeah, well, to get to the earlier point there, whether it's Juncker or Christine Lagarde, they have this notion of the divine right that we used to see in the feudal period, and with kings believing they had a direct line of contact. And you see this with the holy wars now around the world. People believe they speak for God. And Juncker, when he hands down his edicts, he believes in his mind that he's speaking for God in like a Louis the 14th or Louis the 15th kind of way. And this is what happens when you allow bureaucrats unlimited capital at 0% interest to make as many stupid mistakes as possible.
It's a despotism that they're despotism. Unelected, so they're beyond any sort of even democracy. So as Aristotle said, you went from a republic to a democracy to a despotism. And I want to also remind you of a quote from the Constitutional Convention in 1787 when Ben Franklin, when he came out, was asked by a woman. She said, "Doctor, what have we got, a republic or a monarchy?" And he replied, "A republic, if you can keep it." So the people themselves did not keep it. You know, it was on the onus was on them to keep it and remind their elected officials that they are the ones with the unalienable rights. And now we've got to this point where we're so far beyond it that looking at the United States, here is a headline which is pretty shocking. Americans say they are just fine with a mediocre economy. And this is from Bloomberg.com. And they were speaking to Richard Curtin, who's the director of the University of Michigan Survey of Consumers. And it surprised everybody because despite GDP, again, contracting in the U.S., and despite all the horrible stuff going on around the world, a report Friday showed the group's consumer sentiment gauge rose to 96.1 in June, the second highest reading in 8 years. He says the gain in confidence is, quote, due to an improving economy from the consumer perspective, but it also may reflect the acceptance of the diminished economic prospects in the years ahead. They rate and what they would have considered in a bygone era to be rather modest or mediocre growth more positively. I assume people are just capitulating and they're just accepting their lot and just accepting this despotism.
Most Americans, if they had their way, they'd be huddled in a covered wagon in the middle of the plain somewhere, surrounded by the indigenous population, throwing tomahawks and shooting them with arrows. They'd love that. They'd love that kind of romance of the trail. Homesteading, and this is what the American people love. I mean, the idea of being European, living in a chateau, sipping fine wine all day, Americans don't like that stuff. They want to be on the front line battling somebody, whether it's having their own battle against each other in the Civil War, having a Revolutionary War against their imperial oppressors, or battling indigenous population and their push west. Americans, that's what makes them happy.
But what I'm saying is they seem to have given up, because even in Denton, Texas, one of the most armed states in the whole United States, where they'll gun somebody down for just looking at them the wrong way. Here, they have the Second Amendment. That's the only right that remains in the United States. And yet they didn't take up arms. They didn't, fight back when they voted. They went to the polls. They voted and said, "Frackers, get out of our town. Stop poisoning our water." And the legislator says, "No, you can't ban it. You're not allowed to." And they're like, "Oh, okay."
Well, I mean, the Second Amendment law has not functioned as it was originally designed for 100 years in America. I mean, now guns are more of a unit of currency, like packages of Tide detergent and other forms of currency that spring up periodically. It's a currency. It's not a weapon as such, because if it was, it would be used as the Constitution mandates. It's not. It's just something that people maintain their value. Like in Greece, before it collapsed, they were buying cars. In America, before an American economy collapses, they're buying guns. Not to defend themselves, but as a unit of value. They realize the gun will have value. They'll be able to sell it to some, you know, drug dealer or something.
Oh, and by the way, this chart goes with that article about Americans losing steam. Here's like each post-recession period. As you see, we're losing steam. We're just like crumpling into nothing. But you know who's fighting back is not only Greece. Iceland before it fought back as well against this despotism of financial contracts and financialization. But here in the UK, you know, they're having a labor leadership contest, and Jeremy Corbyn is calling the bluff of the creditors as well by saying, extend right to buy to the tenants of private landlords, Labour's Jeremy Corbyn says. So, you know, the right to buy policy, which we called a Ponzi scheme 2 years ago or a year ago when it was introduced, and George Osborne wasn't very happy with that because we called him on it. Well, the right to buy policy that lets council tenants buy their homes at a big discount should be extended to the tenants of private landlords, a Labour leadership contender has said. So this makes sense. Here he's questioning if the government is going to take taxpayer funds and transfer it to certain individuals with a huge discount on taxpayer-financed property in order for them to flip it to a speculator, property speculator, and consolidation of wealth and consolidation of property and entitlement. Well, here, why not just extend that? It makes sense that you should also offer that discount to people who are renting in this economy.
Right. Go down all the way through Chelsea, Mayfair, and go up to people and say, I have a right to buy your flat at a 10 to 20% discount. To make it equal throughout the economy, why selectively only apply this to folks that are living on privately owned properties that are not in Chelsea? Or what about Buckingham Palace? I mean, why don't we just have the right to buy that? We could turn it into something useful, like a coffee shop. I mean, they're not doing anything useful there now except interfere.
And also, he said that he would finance us. Right now, currently, the government spends £14 billion a year subsidizing buy-to-let landlords. So he's saying, take that money, give the £14 billion to private renters, let them buy the private property of the people that bought to let.
Well, Corbyn makes a good sense. It's a good idea. You'd have to apply the standards across the economy. You cannot just selectively pick on one group, decide that they're immoral for some reason, then take all their money.
And then quickly, speaking of money, this is another decline and a shrinking of this situation that we have, this despotism, which nobody else will be allowed to even ever rise up again. Well, the end of interest rates. Why the return on capital will gradually converge to zero. So this guy is arguing that technology makes innovation cheaper, making capital abundant. So he says, during the Industrial Revolution, it was impossible for a person without substantial capital to start a business. Innovation was asset-heavy, mining, steel, etc., and thus required a substantial investment. Today, things have changed significantly. It was never cheaper to innovate or to start a business, and the result is a rapid increase in the supply of capital. Corporations are piling massive amounts of cash. Non-financial U.S. companies alone had more than $1 trillion in cash on their balance sheets at the end of 2014.
Except for energy. For example, you see it in the Bitcoin mining space, it's a play on energy costs. So whoever said that's an idiot, because they assume that energy is going to be free forever, regardless of the manipulation of the price of money and interest rates. You can't get around the price of energy. Duh.
Well, the point is, as well, that that system is vulnerable, it's ending, start a new one, Bitcoin, republicanism, return back to unalienable rights of humans.
I give that five cheek pops. All right, we got to go.
Yeah, tell him, Max. That republic was gone. Well, it was gone before when the Constitution was invented. What do you think the Constitution was for? The federal Constitution was to hold you down, baby. It was an instrument not to hold down the big boys in the ruling class. It was a weapon of the ruling class. That was what the federalization was, along with their ability to make treaties. Once the ability to make treaties was incorporated in the Constitution, it wasn't worth the paper it was written on. People think, oh, they keep the ruling class keeps telling you that. That Constitution's there to protect you. Oh, I see. That's why they've got, what, 10 federal district courts all the way from New York to Hawaii. that are in place to guard the gates of the wealthy to make sure that if you get out of hand that they'll drop on you like a stink on a skunk? Yeah. You think those federal courts are there to protect your rights? What fools we mortals be. Those federal courts are there to guard the gates of the system in case you get out of line, because they've got you taught and trained to obey the law. Always obey the law. We must worship the law. I guess a lot of that comes out of Christ's insanity, like the law is God. Well, I say nothing on paper supersedes nature's law. So when anything on paper clashes with nature's law, then nature's law takes over. And when it comes to a country with 300 million guns and the only people with the balls to use them are the niggers, well, I don't know. I don't have any faith in the population anymore. I thought I once did, but, you know, and also this Foot kid, in reading his paperwork, he had the paperwork right, but the problem, like everybody that does these kind of things, they start at the bottom. The people on the street, the dummies sitting at church who have really no power, any power. If he'd have started with the Black Congressional Caucus, now that might have been interesting. But these people who come uncorked never seem to get the point. You can't change anything by eliminating people on the street, the poor people. If you're going to eliminate it by anybody, you got to start at where the power is. Am I advocating it? Well, if I thought it had a chance, I would, but there's nobody around with the tactical skills and ability and wherewithal and desire that'll do it, except we've had two or three people who have heart in the right place that have made a very good try, but I hate to see people just throw their lives away for nothing when they haven't even made a dent. Because they go for the bottom. You know, it's like a guy's approaching you with a gun or a pitchfork, and you take your .45 and you're shooting him at the feet. Well, the one thing I learned in the military is that may be okay if you want to just take a guy out of the battle and then it takes three more guys to carry him around. But if you want him really out of the picture, you don't shoot at his feet. You take your .45 and shoot him right between the eyes. Yeah, that's the way that works. So anyhow, until you're ready to break up this mess and reconstitute the state sovereignty of the states and clean house in the states, because your state capitals are full of the same kind of rats that are in Washington, except they're just smaller and farther down on the pay scale. Until you're ready to do that, I'm just going to sit here and talk, because I wouldn't pick up a gun and go out there like a maniac. And when I know that there isn't anybody, or there's only a few people out there that would even think about doing things like that. So anyhow, that's what Tommy's got to say. But make sure you watch that before you think about, you know. And then I think of Wilson, that son of a bitch that took us into World War I, and all the guys who went over there and got gassed. And you'll see all that footage of these gassed soldiers and all that in this series, The Great War Diaries. And the guys worshipped like a great hero, Woodrow Wilson and Roosevelt, and all these warmongering sons of bitches that send thousands and thousands of young men to die over some pissy-ass disagreement like the First World War started, just because a couple of alleged anarchists knocked off a couple of blue bloods. It gradually developed into a war around the world. The First World War was a world war, if there ever was one. And then they brought the niggers in to kill white people in Europe. And they did it in World War II, too. And Civil War, they both the South and the North employed niggers to kill white people. So anyhow, until we start admitting what the fuck is wrong and get down to basics, nothing will ever change. Nothing. Well, now that I've had my Thursday rant here, I think it's time to get back into our study of the terrible days. Terrible Tommy reads The Terrible Days. But it's my opinion we're heading back that way as fast as we can, because with the collapse of a dollar as an international powerhouse, it's unbelievable what's probably going to happen. But it's not going to be good. It's not going to end well, as they say in the movies. Well, what was it like for the common man in the wintertime in the old days? There is no room for snow in the city, but it falls on it just the same, heaping the streets with chaos and the mayor with crises. In a heat wave, the residents look to the gods for relief, but in a snowstorm, they turn quixotically to his honor. And ultimately, an untimely snowstorm in New York can cost the mayor his reelection. As the budget melts away and his citizens tramp angrily through the glacial streets, snow removal is a troublesome, costly operation, but the results today are a singular success when compared with those of the 1870s and 1880s. In fact, the word removal, when applied to that period, grossly overstates the operation. The snow remained. It was merely shifted, if at all, a few yards. Keeping the streets clear for the horse trolleys was the uppermost priority, and the cumbersome 18 plows banked the sidewalks with enormous heaps of snow. Well, here in my hometown, here they do it here in the winter, they heap it in the middle of the street. So you've got every half a block, when you got a bad snow, you got this giant mountain of snow about 15 feet high. Cars can get around it, but they just leave it set there until they find time, the mayor find times to cart it off. Often becoming stuck themselves, the plows aggravated the public's misery by blocking the roads to other traffic. Extra horses sometimes were harnessed to free the machines, and an uproar ensued as the straining animals were lashed by their handlers and cursed by onlookers. I think if my estimation's right, this next winter's going to be a Lollapalooza, because if this precipitation of rain we've been getting every day or every other day here in the Midwest follows through to the winter and that turns into snow, we're going to be in the middle of what Al Capp called Lower Slabovia. It was not uncommon for trolley passengers to disembark and push their cars as its horses floundered, unable to find their footing on the icy surface. The less ambitious helped the driver whip his animals. The pedestrians could fall all they wanted to, but if a horse fell, it would delay the trolley car and could not be tolerated. Electric trolley car, introduced to the city streets in 1887, was a sophisticated advance in transport technology, welcomed by the people who were accustomed to its heretofore cruder and more bellicose apparatus. It provided the catalyst to urban expansion, and by the turn of the century, over 1 million New Yorkers had resettled in outlying districts. Heralded as fast, cheap transportation, the electric trolley attracted the mass of citizens who once more were to experience the unhappy discrepancy between promise and delivery. Well, you've got profit in between, that's why. Impeded continually by traffic snarls they helped create, the trolleys seldom reached their designed speed of 20 to 25 miles an hour. For long stretches, they were forced to keep step behind the horse cars, which were not abandoned when their electrified successors reappeared. The mixed marriage of incompatible modes of transport was a bad one, but it persisted for years. Monumental tie-ups occurred daily. And long into the age of electricity, the average speed of urban traffic was predeterminately prescribed by the horse, along with the inconvenience electric cars brought to the metropolitan centers came the unattractive jumble of overhead wires. Chicago ran her cars in pairs through the busiest streets, an insane concession to laissez-faire capitalism. H.G. Wells, usually sympathetic towards urban growth, found Chicago's streets in 1906, quote, simply chaotic, one hoarse cry for discipline, unquote. The discipline came later with the municipal ownership of the lines. In other words, the government had to take over the streetcar business because the ruling class was trying to squeeze too much profit out of it. Moreover, the 5-cent fare of the day, 10 cents on the L, was not considered cheap, especially by workmen with large families. Streetcar fares cost low-income travelers almost 10% of their pay, which averaged less than 25 cents an hour. Interesting, huh? Do they teach any of this in the school? I don't think so. The rags and riches paradox of America during the Gilded Age was nowhere more visible than New York City. The poor lived close by the rich, and the contrast in their housing embarrassed those of sensitivity, troubled those of conscience, and mocked those of faith. Tenements huddled pitifully in the shadow of mansions, and next to the splendors of Fifth Avenue were the rocky wastes of Shantytown, that in the 1880s extended from 42nd to 110th Street. This counterpoint of squalor and luxury was compared by a British traveler to a lady with diamonds around her neck and her toes sticking out of shabby shoes. New York's reputation of the period was that of a gay, not that kind of gay, raffish high society, whose ostentation and carryings-on diverted attention from the despair and the realities of life among the poor and the lower middle class. Gee, I thought it was such a wonderful era. Well, if you were rich and in the ruling class, it was pretty nice as it could be. Decent accommodation at modest rentals was non-existent as a housing famine proved an economic calamity to the mass of city residents. Trapped in serfdom, poor families were unable to escape the slums, and unwilling to, perhaps, because of ethnic ties and the proximity to casual jobs. Except for those who were very rich, it is impossible to live in the city with any degree of decency, unquote. Even in the fine brownstones, life was commonly short of the serene orderliness suggested by their facade. Townhouses give a city architectural balance. They soften the heavy presence of commercial and institutional buildings. Among the fashionable of New York, it is now considered chic to own one. The handsome facades have not been altered since the Gilded Age, but the interiors have, and for good reason. In their heyday, these houses were stuffy, difficult to maintain, and occasionally injurious to health. A basic problem was the polluted air that permeated almost all sections of the city. Brownstone residents were advised to keep their windows permanently shut against the outside air, which was redolent with a mixture of soot, factory vapors, and animal stenches, unquote. Indoors, because of the lack of ventilation, the air was comparable in quality, if not worse. Sewer gas from the primitive drainage systems posed a constant peril to health. Dampness and odors plagued the homes of the rich and poor alike. The indoor air was befouled further by the standard coal stove, which gobbled oxygen in exchange for soot and dust. Central steam heat provided a costly $2,000 to $4,000 alternative in the 1880s, but the early radiators were afflicted by a novel form of nuisance, water hammer and hissing. One wonders, have you ever heard that? I remember as a kid being in buildings where they had steam heat, and how the all of a sudden bang, bang, bang you'd hear on the radiator. And steam, too, would let off of these things. Yeah, I'm an old fart. One wonders if the brownstone resident, annoyed by these noises, was consoled by the thought that the air was cleaner. In one area of personal care, the Victorians appeared untroubled. They seldom bathed. Glorification of the bathroom is a modern fetish. In 1882, only 2% of New York's homes had water connections. And these, in all probability, were leaking, and if attached to a stove, dangerous. Bathing was considered harmful by some doctors, and one C.E. Sargent described it as a needless waste of time, unquote. In an ornate or overstuffed townhouse, regular chores from bathing the baby, generally approved, to dusting and cleaning were a grinding toil, but most worrisome of all was cooking. Preparation of a Victorian dinner was a monumental task in a kitchen of Spartan design. The servant problem was insoluble. In general, American girls were too proud to seek menial jobs, and immigrant girls were unsatisfactory as a result of the language barrier, their temperament, and their ignorance of domestic social customs. And capable girls refused to stay because of the enormous workload. The townhouse required an unremitting war with its refusal to stay clean, orderly, warm, ventilated, nourished, and pleasant. In public affection, the landlord's rating was comparable to that of a kidnapper, and the richer he was, the more likely he was to deserve it. His victim, the tenant, is today protected by the law, but 100 years ago he was vulnerable, ignorant, and utterly misused. New York's soaring population, augmented by the continuing influx of Europeans, aggravated the housing shortage and inflated real estate values. Keen as foxes to the scent of the weaker game, capitalist speculators piously came to the rescue by building the cheapest form of tenements. Cracked walls, sagging floors, and a total absence of fire exits were features of these neglected buildings, whose dingy, overcrowded rooms drew extortionate rents. Landlords bullied the poor and middle-class families with yearly rent increases and unpardonably brutal evictions. You see, so if you got a raise on a job or if you worked harder, they just taxed you with higher rents. Boarding houses for New Yorkers who became casualties of the rent spiral, the boarding house offered a solution, though not an ideal one. For $3 to $5 a week, the clerk or the working girl could find refuge here, along with childless couples, adventurers, and ne'er-do-wells. Together, they comprised a true cross-section of America's transient population, a culture of homeless who were bound to a fixed place by neither blood nor tradition. Now, we had that when I was a kid here in this town I lived by. In fact, my mother and I, my single mother and I, lived in one of these houses where you had several individuals living in separate rooms, and then you would come down usually and have a common meal together. And that was very common practice back then for people who could not really afford to rent a house or buy a house, that's for sure. So that's the way my mother met my stepfather, because I used to go out in a hall as a three-year-old kid, and run up and down the hall, and my stepfather, future stepfather, would give me pennies and nickels and get me on his side. And that's how my mother met my stepfather. It was in one of these. These weren't totally bad either, because if they were clean places with clean rooms, and reasonable prices and a common meal for dinner. They worked out pretty good. And they were pretty cheap. And it afforded usually a widow with a large house a way of keeping the house. In fact, the house that I'm talking about, where my mother and I lived, is still here and still looks exactly the same as the day we left it. No invention of the Gilded Age, the boarding house had flourished before the Civil War in frontier cities and towns as vital elements in the nation's growth. You know, out west, too, they used to, a lot of times, guys would both sleep in the same bed. And that's where a nasty rumor got started about Lincoln, that he was maybe homosexual. Well, no, that was a common practice because they didn't have a lot of beds. So in the frontier, if you're a traveler, a lot of times you just had to share a bed with some other guy. It didn't mean you were a queer. Well, you could have been. Charles Dickens, among others, missed their significance when he waspishly compared America's rootless ways with those of the English. Domestic moralists saw them as a threat to Victorian rectitude that loosened family ties and encouraged sinful liaisons. No doubt these dangers existed, but for legions of with meager resources, the boarding house was home. That's right. The need for the apartment house existed for many years before its evolution. The boarding house and the tenement were too little. The townhouse was too much. And I don't remember this town I lived next to where I was born. I don't remember them even having a hotel here in town. They may have, but I don't remember. I know they had a big motel at a little place near here, Winona Lake, which is the home of the Bible Conference and all the religious nuts, and it used to be big time on the lake at Winona Lake, and they had a giant hotel out there where Billy Sunday and all those guys used to hang out, preach in the daytime and drink at night. The predictions that but nobody in town, were a working class person, could afford to stay in that hotel. Only the preachers and the people who had a lot of non-taxed money coming in could afford that. The predictions that New Yorkers' intense frustration of city life literally forced the development of the apartment building, which was to convert millions of Americans into cliff dwellers. The flight from private dwellings began with the well-to-do whose townhouses had become a financial burden for even the rich. Richard M. Hunt created the prototype of a new style of housing in his Stuyvesant apartments on 18th Street in New York, contrary to dire predictions that New Yorkers would never consent to live live on mere shelves under a common roof. This building and similar ones that followed it proved very successful. Class privilege was safeguarded by rents up to $3,000 for 7 rooms, and that was the old days. Reassured by the acceptance of communal living by the wealthy, real estate entrepreneurs built low-rent apartment houses for the middle class. But these structures, which soon mushroomed into the American cities, were little more than glorified tenements, and the style of living that was a pleasure for the rich became, in imitation, a curse to the wage earner. As a contemporary observed, quote, reasonable apartments are not good, and good apartments are not reasonable, unquote. Well, there you go. Greed enters the room again. Always lurking there. Greed, greed, greed. Families were shelved in layers, shared floors, and were subdivided into several apartments. 3 or 4 tiny rooms providing no insulation from the neighbors' cooking smells or babies' squallings. Garbage removal and sanitary facilities were comparatively wretched, and overcrowding made the buildings more difficult to manage than the tenement houses of the slum districts. As the size and number of apartment buildings increased, so too did the danger that a fire would turn them into blazing prisons. Of course, they were not the only fire traps, but they accounted for the heaviest loss of life in the great conflagrations of the period. Between 1870 and 1906, four American cities, Chicago, Boston, Baltimore, and San Francisco, burned to the ground, a record unmatched anywhere else in the world. Boston's assessment of its yearly fire damage was from $1 to $1.5 million. And that was in the old days when a buck was a buck. Anyhow, it was 10 times greater than that of a European city of the comparable size. The frequency and destructiveness of fires in the American cities were blamed on shoddy construction and the use of flammable materials in the construction of fireproof apartments. Now, guess who would be doing all this? You know, your predatory capitalist types of white Aryans and the Jews and people like that, or anybody who could get a little money together and screw everybody else. Even as late as 1904, after steel had replaced the less heat-resistant cast iron for buildings, 7,000 lives were lost in city fires. Nowhere is the fireman more celebrated than in the United States, and for sound sound historical reasons. The word shanty is of Gaelic origin and means old house. You know, I used to have a friend who was quite a good heavy-duty racist, friend of George Wallace and so forth. He used the term shanty Irish, which was an insult to Irish people. He didn't seem to have a lot of respect for the Irish, at least of the old days. So they had the term shanty Irish. The word shanty is of Gaelic origin and means old house. To the laborers who lived in shanties in the coal regions of Pennsylvania, the meeting must have been seemingly unnecessarily flattering. Strewn over the landscape like so many abandoned rotting crates, some actually perched with macabre inspiration on slag heaps, they were home to thousands of European workers, white workers, and their families. The white industrialists who provided these homes, which dismayed even the humblest of the wretched newcomers, rationalized easily, quote, they were only foreigners. There was no use giving them anything decent, for they weren't used to decent surroundings and wouldn't appreciate them if they had them, unquote. And you wonder who the enemy is? You don't have to travel far. In New York, meanwhile, the same type of dwelling had taken flourishing root on the periphery of the city, which until the turn of the century was largely open land. For thousands of families, squatting in their own wretched box was more endurable than life in a tenement. In the good old days, common alternatives were degrees of ignominy. Well, yeah, people, when I was a kid here in this town, we had a place called Little Kentucky, and it was about a mile square, maybe not quite that big, and it was in an area of the town where the property wasn't worth as much, and a lot of white Kentuckians came to Warsaw to work in the foundries and the factories, because we've always had a pretty good industrial base here. And they were treated worse than niggers are today, I can guarantee you that. I know that for a fact. I had a paper route to deliver papers in a shantytown. Of course, not too many people in shantytown even subscribed to the paper. But it was shameless how these ne'er-do-wells in this white town treated white Kentuckians. Now, sometimes they deserved it, but most of the time they didn't. And I've told people before that when I was in about the fourth or fifth grade in grade school at West Wayne School in Warsaw, there were certain bullies around who liked to push their weight around, and couple of them had decided to pick on me. Well, it just happened that we had two big strapping, actually they seemed like they were 6'10" white Kentuckians that had failed a few grades and were big for their age and were in my class. And I made friends with them, and they took care of my problem. Just like, praise to Joe Pesci. I had my two Joe Pescis, and they took care of me, and I treated them good. So anyhow, now, after all these decades, these Kentuckians have transformed into whatever, and into this town, and some of them are even in the wealthier class. So shows you white people can come from really crummy backgrounds and make it. The formless squatter encampments surrounding the city like a ring of scum around a tub, built of discarded boxes and construction site refuse. The hovels presented a grotesque counterpoint to the fashionable areas nearby. That reminds me of this little Kentucky. My paper routes started basically there, and within a mile out Country Club Drive, it was all the wealthy class, the owners of the foundries, the owners of the newspaper, and all that, which was around the shores of a big resort lake. So you went from dire poverty for 1 mile to the rich of the community. It was really something and gave me a pretty good idea what the class system is like. I saw it every day when I delivered papers. When the American Museum of Natural History opened its doors in 1877, it stood in majestic relief amid the wreckage of a new civilization. The inhabitants of Shantytown lived within the city but did not belong to it. Democracy's flotsam, they lived in unspeakable squalor and ignored, resented, and in good times pitied. Oh yeah, we had a lot of white solidarity back then, didn't we? I don't think it's not that bad today. I mean, you know, I think people are a little more kinder, at least on the surface, to poor people, especially in the smaller communities, than they were back then. 100 years after the founding fathers, and I hate that word, founding real estate speculators is more like it, had dedicated themselves to forming a new nation based on man's innate indignity, millions of its citizens wallowed in degradation, which means it was never designed to be a nirvana for the working class in the very beginning. It was always destined to be just an imitation England. These were the slum dwellers, the losers in the system that exalted the individual. They came by the slums through a quirk of fate, and once in them, they fell victim to plagues of body and mind that produced crime, drunkenness, disease, and early death in a remorseless cycle. The authors of the Federal Constitution could not have foreseen this blight on their earnest hopes. Well, that's bullshit. You don't have to be a magician to look into the future a little bit based upon what's going on around you now. If you know what's going on around you now, it don't take a genius to figure out what's coming, at least in the short run. The slums, curiously, were a natural result of the optimism that marked the good old days, the rampant growth of industry and the population that turned towns into cities and adventurers into exploiters with bewildering speed. As always, the devil had to have his due, and he was paid in slums. Cleveland's infected area was known as the Flats. In St. Louis, it was Cross Keys and Clabber Alley. In Boston, the North End. Chicago's extensive slums adjoined the stockyards. Street after street of pitiful wreckage lacking sanitation, drainage, ventilation, light, and safety. But worst of all, typically, was New York. And I want to tell you, these cities are moving back in that direction. When I took the South Shore train from South Bend, Indiana, which is about 100 miles from Chicago. And as we began to enter Gary and these northwestern cities in Indiana, we were entering the ghetto, the spilling over of the black population from Chicago into Indiana, which has become a scourge. But anyhow, you sit there and look out the windows at the houses along the tracks as you get through Gary and Hammond up there, and you'll see hundreds of burned out, abandoned houses, either boarded up or burned out, all the way almost into Chicago. I mean, so the menace is growing again. We're going backwards instead of forwards. And, of course, the black race is helping us. And, of course, the artificial suppression of wages is helping, too. So you can't blame it all on the blacks, either, because there are black people out there that do work. But I saw many houses along there that were nice family houses that had been boarded up and people just left. It's too bad we can't get a brigade of white people who need places and go in there and take over whole blocks of those areas and rebuild them and make sure that they're protected, you know, by the force of muscle and gun. Between 1868 and 1875, an estimated 500,000 living in New York slums, about half of the city's population. As many as 8 persons shared a living room that was 10 feet by 12 feet, and a bedroom 6 by 8. Now that's the size, I think, of a cell in prison, 6 by 8. And these are free people, supposedly. They really weren't, because they were victims of wage slavery. That's what killed me when the blacks got their freedom and they went from physical slavery right into they went from chattel slavery into wage slavery as they moved north, and at the same time destroying the incomes of the white labor struggle and watering down the unions in the north. So they didn't change, they just shifted. They just changed locations. One tenant of the Lower East Side was packed with 101 adults and 91 children. And you want to go to war in a foreign country and kill somebody you never met when those conditions were right here? Your killing should have been right here, not over there, and it still is. Among the indignities they were forced to suffer, all noted by city health inspectors, were vile toilets, dirt-filled sinks, slop oozing down the stairwells, children urinating on the walls, dangerously dilapidated stairs, plumbing pipes pockmarked with holes that emitted sewer gases so virulent they were flammable. Even among slum residents, there was a ghastly hierarchy, at the top of which were the cellar dwellers. Their quarters acted as a repository for street filth that washed down on rainy days, caked a floor that men, women, and children often shared with goats and pigs. Quote, the inmate exhibited the same lethargic habits as animals burrowing into the ground, unquote. And I bet you didn't think this ever existed, did you? I think every white family should have this book. An absorbing footnote is the fact that the rent per square foot of the slums of the period was 25 to 35% higher than that of apartments in fashionable uptown New York. You see, these kind of places were bought up by white trash, middle, upper middle class whites, Jews, and people like that to act as predators on the poor. And once in a while, the poor would rise up and slit their throats, which was a good thing. The slumlords, unable to resist profits of 50 to 70% of their original investment, squeezed tenants mercilessly. Politicians, exclusively club members, and even churches were among the owners. Yeah. Oh, the Jesus people exploiting the poor? I can't believe it, except what do you think the wealth of St. Peter's in Rome is built on? The back of the poor and the ignorant, who no doubt rationalized their greed as the mine operators did for their workers' shacks. Oh yeah, it's getting juicier all the time. In 1874, a New York social worker, Etta Angel Wheeler, found a little girl wandering naked through the slums. The child had been beaten and slashed by her drunken foster mother and then chased from home. Unable to find a haven for her, Miss Wheeler asked the Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals for help. It was decided that the child being an animal, the society would give it protection. Well, aren't we all in the end higher animals, sometimes even lower animals? I think animals in most cases are more honest and treat each other better than we do. An animal, the end product of slum life, disfigured by the bestiality of home, thousands of urchins wandered the streets. An 1880 estimate had 100,000 loose in New York, cunning, predatory, with an instinct for survival that rivaled an alley cat's. You see, that's what happens when push comes to shove and people get their self totally against the wall. They will revert to basic animal survival. And it'll happen again. It always does. And then Mad Max. They slept under doorways in discarded boxes and barrels. They fought, blasphemed, begged, and stole. And in the end, they gravitated to prostitution and crime. It was the natural succession of their unnatural orbit. Oh, you thought rural life was better? Well, let's check it out. It is difficult to think of... Oh, wait a minute. I'm not going to go into rural life today. I've morphed you out already today, so we're going to stop there, and we'll get back into it tomorrow on Friday, Freya's Day. So anyhow, I think you got the message. If you got any comments, make them. And I hope you spread this. We'll get these radio shows based on this book. Get them out there. I think young people, especially kids, should hear this stuff. And because we keep repeating the same shit all over again. When things get bad, we go to war. Yeah, well, take your mind off living in a dirty slum or whatever. Take your mind off all these rats that run your government and your state governments, and get your mind on, well, let's go kill some goddamn Muslims. That'll get their mind off things. I'll see you tomorrow. Terrible Tommy's gone.
I'm going to make him an offer again with you.
In other words, let's quit pissing around and give them an offer they can't refuse. How about it?